So I got an awesome vacuum. It takes like 5 minutes. It just doesn't like take your any time sick at all.
Backpack vacuum, right? You just walk around.
It's not a backpack, but it's like a big stick, you know? So it's like the same. Yeah, oh. So it's pretty fun. It's very powerful. So it's like feels like I'm wielding a weapon, you know? It's like it's got a trigger and everything. So you hold it like a gun. It makes a cool, gun. Like, yeah, it makes a cool sci-fi noise where it's like, it goes like, boo. Like, you turn it on.
Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 283 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm not the games programmer.
I'm Sam, and I'm wearing blue.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is October 3rd, 20 Blundy.
Is today Halloween?
No.
When's Halloween?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow's Halloween. So this is the, so this we is are spooky eve.
Mm-hmm. It's yes, it's spooky eve. We're in pre-spook mode right now. I'm feeling it. Are you guys feeling it?
This is where you get. Yes. This is sort of like the you know the tingle on the back of your neck where you're like something's coming.
Yeah.
That's where we're at. Mm-hmm.
Something spooky's about to happen. Also, before we go any further, warning: there's going to be some profanity on this show.
So good job. We talked for a whole 2 minutes and nobody cussed. So
I feel. Oddly medium about that.
Yeah, could have been spicier.
Could have been. It wasn't, though. We'd also like to thank our recurring supporters over at podcast.bscotch.net. Thanks for letting us grab your money. We like it. All right. Let's talk about life. First of all, it is spooky. It's dark. It's wet. It's cold. Mm-hmm. It has been a fucking gloomy 2 weeks. Yeah. I don't know. How are you guys feeling about this?
Well, I don't know how it's been for everybody else because, of course, this is the weather problem, which is our weather isn't everybody's weather, but it has been like just gray outside.
It has just been gray. Just we have gray. Actually have sun for the first time in 2 weeks today. Mm-hmm. It is it's been really hitting us, I feel like.
Yeah,
you can feel
those of us with that seasonal affective disorder or SAD, which, by the way, the best naming ever.
Spot on acronym. Yep.
For a little one of those mental things. It's been hitting everybody, I think, at least a little bit. And I know for me, at one point, it was 6 o'clock and it was pitch black outside because it was already cloudy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I was like, do I keep on doing anything or is this just like, should I just stop?
I just shotgun a sleeve of Oreos and then go lay on the bed moaning?
Yeah. Yeah. I generally, last winter, it was the first time I started to really feel the, I don't know if that needs a clinical diagnosis or what it was, but definitely the constant lack of sunlight and like just being trapped inside that whole thing, you know, like definitely pushed me into a more of a depressed state than is my normal. Enough that it was, it just kind of made me just not want to do as much stuff and then that whole thing. So I definitely had that for the first time last winter and I never quite recovered all the way. It just like, I got like part of the way back up as the sun started to come out. And now we're getting ready for another round, you know. And since I'm starting a little bit lower than I did even last year, I'm like,
it's possible that you didn't recover because in mid March, about the time the sun starts to return, we all got locked indoors.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, there is that. Well, and then you couple that with we've been talking a fair bit on the podcast about ADHD and all that kind of stuff. And one of the impacts of I don't know if you call it comorbidity or what the thing is, but one of the things that goes along with adult ADHD and also young person ADHD is various levels of anhedonia, which is absence of joy, which is a symptom of depression, but not quite the same thing. It's all very like muddled and like intermixed and so on. But so there's this possibility there too that because I know that one of the things I've noticed too is that the working from home it's a different enough thing. And the absence of another person in my physical presence makes it a lot easier for me to engage in the kind of behaviors that social pressure normally like prevents me from doing, having my mind wander during a meeting, right? Because during a meeting, like when you know you're looking at somebody else's eyeballs because there's not a camera you're looking through, you don't know where people are looking, then I'm like I have to remind myself to maintain eye contact, which reminds me to pay attention, right?
But you're maintaining eye contact with nothing.
Yeah.
Because there are no eyes.
Yeah, there's no eyes. So I've been noticing it's been getting harder and harder for me just to like deal with some aspects of work when working from home.
Yep.
And even like my evenings have gotten harder to deal with, and my weekends have gotten harder to deal with, and everything. So I'm just like, all this stuff is kind of coalescing.
It's creepy. This.
Yeah. So I took two active steps. One is I got a sad light, or a happy light, I guess, because it's true. You know, to try to make
it's an anti-sad.
Wait, what do they call it? Is it called a is it called happy light?
It's got some bullshit name, but it is a particular kind of light. I can't remember what the name is you're supposed to search for because. There's some criteria you have to hit. So these are lights that are supposed to like mimic the brightness of the sun so that.
Well, not directly. It's like the sun on a cloudy day at least.
Yeah. So it's better than not just like being pitch black outside. Yeah, it's not literally blinding you. Like
yeah, you're not like staring into the sun.
Yeah, so it has to be like 10,000 lumens, which is, you know, seems like a good number of lumens. I'm not a lumens expert, but that seems like a lot.
I think your typical light bulb will have between 700 and 1400 lumens.
Yeah, something like that. For like a
but I don't know. Is it a log scale?
I don't know.
How do lumens work?
What even is a lumen?
Yeah.
And why is that the word?
And how do they get so many of them into such a small space?
Well, it's like one of those. Have you ever seen those GIFs or the videos of like those, basically these equivalent sad lights, but the flashlights people have, like a tactical flashlight? So they'll be out camping or something and they turn it on and it's like, it's just daytime now. Wherever they point, right. It's just daytime. You know?
Well, those are the ones where they describe it as like 10 million candle power.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
This is –
it's like horse
this
power.
Is like, you know? Yeah, this is like some
– like hilariously some archaic.
1800s shit.
Yeah, like, well, especially because like there's no way to make that make any meaningful sense. You know?
No, it's a million candles is just a bonfire and that's not that bright. Yeah.
But you also, what is a candle as a unit of measurement? It's absurd. You know, it's like
yeah, how many it's like candles using, has the average person lit in their life? Like, I don't even have. I probably lit like maybe a couple dozen candles aside from birthday cake candles. You know what I mean? Ever in my life.
So,
like,
but also, are all candles the same enough? You know that you can use it as a metric.
That
like, same question. Same can be said about horses.
I feel like horses are more different amongst themselves than candles. Because candles, it feels like you light it, like the flame all kind of looks the same. You know, it's so like I can kind of buy into that one. Sure. Versus like a human foot, and it's like those aren't the same size, so it's crazy to use that as a metric. Mm-hmm. Or a horse,
which is an entire animal,
which is a whole animal. It's got like a brain that could be different than another one's brain. The sizes are different, you know.
At least we've moved it. We've moved past candles and into lumens. You know, we've made it.
You got to make it abstract enough that you're like, I can't even possibly understand what this is. So
yeah, perfect.
It's fine.
So now I can believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the extra steps I took. Got a sad light. So if you're gonna get one of these things, then do your research. I did my best guess because it. There's no way to know what is a good thing for, but I found something that was well reviewed. I haven't really tried it out yet because it kind of got sunny the moment I got it. But I also, for lights, replaced all the lights in my office with bright as fuck ones. The daylight ones, you know, that are on the blue end of the spectrum.
Interesting.
And that actually immediately, like, has made me feel better just like every day, just like being in like bright light all day. So there's a truth to this, definitely. And then the second active step I took was to finally make an appointment with a psychiatrist to get officially evaluated for ADHD to see if like, is that a thing I'm doing? Because I don't know if that's a thing I'm dealing with for sure, but there's a lot of consistencies there.
You did take the same self-report quiz thing that I did. And both you guys are –
it's not looking good.
It's looking likely. But it is interesting with all this mental health stuff, right? Because all of these, you know, quote unquote disorders, right? These are just, you take a whole bunch of metrics that you feel like are kind of related in some way and you put them on a spectrum and you kind of ask where people fall on each one of those things. But those things aren't guaranteed to be correlated, which is why it's a messy process. Mm-hmm. But also each of those things can also be listed in some other thing. Right. So if there's a potential for like autism, or if there's a potential for depression, or if there's a potential for like any number of things, like those are just a collection. It's a bundle of features, each one having a spectrum, right? And there's overlap between all of them. And so when someone's trying to figure out like what's going on in your brain, what makes you different, right? The fact is there's 1,000 things that are different. And then you just try to see if like the Venn diagram like roughly matches up with a collection that has a definition on it that there's a word for and that hopefully has some sort of a treatment process for.
Yeah. So it could be like, I'm having some severe mood swings. And it's like, well, you could be bipolar, you could have ADHD, or you need a nap.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's a range of possible outcomes here. And it's all dependent on, like you said, the bundle of other things you have going on, mm-hmm. how consistent it is.
Yep.
You know, there's tons of, it's very hard to
figure out. It's been one of the interesting things for me, for looking into this for myself, trying to figure out like, how's my brain work? What's going on there, right? If you look at like the symptoms of ADHD or the symptom doesn't feel like the right word, the consequences of it, right? On different aspects of your life. And there's a whole bunch of them that, since I also have aphantasia, which we talked about in a past episode, which is like can't picture things in my mind. There's a whole bunch of like ADHD effects that would also be fully explained by the fact that I can't picture stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's kind of like interesting stuff here where it's like, so what?
So there's
no way to know actually what's going on. And so that's why you need a professional who also is just doing their best because this is a messy fucking process.
Yeah, this is interesting. I think, so we talked, I don't believe we actually brought it on the podcast, but a few weeks ago, I had some panic attacks the first time ever in my life. Mm-hmm. And right before bed, a couple panic attacks for a couple of nights in a row, and which was weird. So basically what happened was that it happened to me and then I got up because basically what it does is it jacks a bunch of adrenaline and stuff into your bloodstream. So I was a little excited. I got up and I was like, that was fucking weird. Just felt like I was dying briefly. And then I Googled it cause I was like, what? I just thought I had COVID cause I couldn't breathe. I was like, couldn't breathe.
Yeah, people also liken it to heart attack symptoms in the sense of like,
yep.
It's funny because people call it a panic attack. And if you haven't, I haven't had one. And so as a consequence of not having one and then given that name, I would assume that if I had one, I'd be like, oh, I'm panicking. That is the sensation. But that's not what it actually feels like when a person. No,
it basically just feels like something is deeply wrong and you're very freaked out about it.
And your adrenaline is just through the roof. And
yeah. Well, so in my case, my heart rate didn't necessarily get super jacked up, but I just felt like I was just like, oh no. Like, so what is happening? And so I Googled it and it's like, you know, put in the stuff. And it was very clearly like, yeah, these are very clear to panic, like sort of by the book.
Sam is really good at having sort of textbook examples of all of his problems.
Yeah, I self-diagnosed with carbon monoxide poisoning that one time.
Oh, yep.
where I was like, I have a headache. I'm slightly nauseous. I like type this in.
Did we ever talk about that? How Sam almost died from carbon monoxide poisoning?
I've had many.
Twice, I think. Was it twice? It was twice.
The same apartment building because the landlord is a piece of shit. So
not a great landlord.
Not a good one. But
he dodged a lot of ordinances.
Yeah.
He did.
But yeah. So
and lawsuits.
It is a panic attack. And it was like, so odd. But the problem was, so as far as going back to this comorbidity issue, was that all of the symptoms of generalized anxiety, as well as this panic attack thing, neatly, very frankly, too neatly overlap with some of these early neurological symptoms that mm-hmm. you see in COVID patients.
Yep.
Which, of course, what I was freaking out about was like, what if I have COVID? And then.
But also, those in turn, because you're comparing it to COVID, but if you also compared that to the flu. Or like any one of a dozen other things, it's also an overlap. And this is the thing, mm-hmm. that physicians always talk about, right? If people come in with the symptoms, it's like, I feel just pretty bad, kind of headachy, like maybe mm-hmm. a little dizzy. Like they start going through the list of things. It's like, okay, yeah, that could be literally a thousand yep. things. It's not until something gets really bad where the specifics come out. And then you're like, okay, yeah. Now we can like lock that thing down, right?
Yeah. I think the nefarious thing on that side was that getting anxious about thinking that it was COVID and then seeing worse. That all the symptoms were the same, of course, created this little, this fantastic little death spiral that I was writing last week for a couple of days where it was like, oh man. And then as soon as a couple of days had passed and I hadn't gotten a fever, I was like, oh, I was just tripping.
Oh, right.
I was just tripping.
right.
But I'm curious, Adam, why it is that you decided to take the steps now? Because it's something you've known about for, well, I guess, I don't know.
It's I think it's because as like the darkness was coming upon us.
Yes, more ways than one.
Uh-huh. More ways than one, but actually really specifically the actual physical darkness of the outside. Because it's not unlikely that the rest is also having an impact, but the one that I can like viscerally feel, right, is just the lack of light. Which I know, like I know last year was impactful, and I also know that I didn't fully recover from that. Over the summer. And so I'm kind of like, I got a little bit of trepidation coming from like, for this winter about like, oh no, it's like, cause that means that presumably means it's going to be even worse this year. Right. And so I wanted to take some steps to kind of like prepare for that. But the other part is that in particular for the past, even before it started to get kind of dark, but basically as soon as it started to get a little dark and a little chilly, but just like a little bit. And so the days just weren't quite as long. Then I just started feeling like it, my evenings and weekends in particular were just like there, I feel this like active downward pressure trying to keep me from doing stuff, like even like trivial chores and things, you know? And I know, like, and I know exactly what that is. That's like the classic depression symptom, right?
Yep.
Of like, in that whole idea of, because it's always hard to do stuff, right? That you don't want to do, but the idea of like just literally not doing it, right? It's a weird fucking thing, right? Because it's not like a, oh, I just have to like do this thing I don't want to do. Like, I'm just going to say, okay, just go do this thing and then go do it. Right. Because like you do that and then you still don't, you know, like you still like, no, you're supposed to do anything.
Yeah.
There's a weird disconnect where you just don't, you know? And so I've been feeling that getting like stronger and stronger and stronger to the point where now my weekends and my evenings, like, got a bunch of chores. Like, the amount of dread that I feel for like really simple, it's like, oh, I need to vacuum the downstairs, right? I got this fucking awesome vacuum for that purpose because I hate vacuuming, right? So I got an awesome, powerful vacuum. It takes like 5 minutes. It just doesn't take any time at all. It's like your
sick backpack vacuum, right? You just walk around.
It's not a backpack, but it's like a big stick, you know? So it's like the same. Yeah, so it's pretty fun. It's very powerful. So it's like, feels like I'm wielding a weapon, you know? It's like, it's got a trigger and everything. So you hold it like a gun. It makes a cool, it makes a cool sci-fi noise where it's like, it goes like, boo. Like, you turn it on. It's awesome. So it's a cool fucking vacuum.
Also, that's dope.
Yeah. So I like it. But like, having to like go get it, which it's up one very short flight of stairs. It just takes, again, it would take like 15 seconds. So it's like, oh, I got to go get it. You know, but there's insurmountable hurdle number one. Okay, now I got it. Oh, now I have to like put this head on it. So it's like the carpet head, you know, versus the wood floor head or whatever. Like, takes 5 seconds, but oh, now I have to remember to get both of those. But like, all of it is trivial, but all of it feels weirdly insurmountable to the point where I'm just like, I don't want to do this. You just don't. So I've been feeling that like deepening over the past like couple months in particular. And so I'm trying to, before it gets into a state where, because I had this last year during the winter in particular to some extent, but it feels like it's already worse than that was, which, and I have never had like a significant like deep depression or anything, but I know from other people just how bad that gets.
It gets bad.
Yeah. And so I want to like try to stave that. I want to try to like get that caught before it goes into the part where like I literally can't do anything.
Time to medicate, buddy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. That's how you get around it.
Light sunlight and dry.
Bright lights and medication, presumably. So.
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, so this is all to say, I think it's important that every once in a while we just like could just talk openly about this kind of stuff because there's so much stigma around all of it.
I found it so fascinating because it's like the reality is everybody has issues along these dimensions. And so, not talking about it is a hilarious, it's just a weird
the thing you have to remember.
Agreement because.
Yeah. What are you talking about? I'm a big, strong man and I don't feel things.
You have to remember that we're just a bunch of fucking monkeys, right? Mm-hmm. We're a bunch of monkeys. We put clothes on ourselves for some reason.
We weren't supposed to make it this far.
We weren't supposed to make it. We weren't supposed to be alive. We're here for some reason. And then we've all collectively decided all kinds of completely absurd things. We're like, hey, let's decide that money is a thing. And then if you don't, it's imaginary, but let's decide that's a thing. And if you don't have enough of it, you just starve to death, right? Mm-hmm. That's it. We're going to invent medicine. That's pretty fucking rad, but we're only going to let some people have it, right? Because monkey law, right? So we've established monkey laws, which are just as stupid as the laws that real monkeys would make, right? And so that's then the world in which we live in is one artificially constructed by other random monkeys, right?
And we just got to deal with it.
And we just got to deal with it. You take our monkey brains and you put it in the context of like of other wild maniac monkeys making arbitrary random rules based on the nonsense that they believe. And then we all have to live inside of that
space. I mean, my favorite fact is that the human working memory is just 7 items.
Yeah.
What are we even
doing?
You know?
Yeah. It's like, no. How did we even get here?
So if things aren't going smoothly for you,
that's normal.
Because you're a monkey. under monkey law, you know?
Every now and then you read about studies on primates and stuff where it's like, look at this chimpanzee figured out how to like take a stick and like dip it in a termite mound, and he pulls it out, and then he's covered in termites, and he's just like nom 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 eating termites off the stick. And you look at that, and every now that I think about that as like, you know, cast back, you know, a million years or something, and you got these proto humans, you know, somewhere, and there's this stupid leap where that like this proto human picks up a stick and he's like, I'm gonna dip it in this bug hole and like eat a worm, and then it's like that SpongeBob like 1 million years later, and then yes, suddenly we're all like flying through the fucking
spaceships.
Air. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're like blasting ourselves in the face with million candle power lumens, you know, like
what? And it all started because somehow, some monkey was like, see these termites? These are money now. Mm-hmm. And now here we are.
Here we are.
Yeah. So I think also say if you're having an issue, especially as we head into winter of all the times, is not the time to fuck around.
No, especially not at all. As we're not in winter yet. So like. So get
unless you live on the equator, because it's still super bright and nice outside, and you just do you, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean there's all kinds of other shit that you have to deal with, which is all the rest. You got to deal with of monkey law. You have to deal with, right? Mm-hmm. But
at least you got some sunshine. You got that going for you. okay, yeah,
if you're take active steps, go. If you're not in therapy, probably everybody should be. Period. You should be more embarrassed by not being in therapy than by being in it. So
be ashamed.
Yeah. So there's
apps. New monkey law.
Yeah. The new monkey law. Be ashamed to not be in therapy. There's apps now. You can literally just like get an app. I can't remember. There's like Better Health or whatever. I'm not advocating these because I've never used them, so I don't actually know if they're any good. But
there's a billion of them.
There's a billion of them, and some of them are supposedly really good. Like you can just get an app, and you can like click a button, and then be like, "Ooh, I have a therapist now. I'm talking to you." Right. Like. Just boom, boom, done.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you just get all these balls. Like if you get sad in the winter, check out Sad Lights.
Here's another pro tip:
delete Facebook.
Actually, I've been on Twitter for the past few weeks. For the past few weeks, like I downloaded Twitter for to do something, and I just kind of kept it on my phone, and I kind of got sucked in. And then as I've been like getting more into the kind of depressed state, then middle of last week, I was like, I need to take this off my phone. So I did, and I can't even tell you how much better I felt the next day by just like not looking at Twitter for literally only 24 hours. Like that was, you know,
even though you had only been looking at it for a week,
for a few weeks. Yeah. And so, but like the change in my mood was enormous. So I can't recommend enough getting off of that shit.
And there's built in limits on phones too now. So I found on the iPhone, they have this thing where you can set which apps are basically available. And then the other ones, if you open it, it just there's a little timer, and it's like you've already reached your limit for today. And this is great because I just turn this on, period, for everything. And then so if I want to, for example, check in on Instagram, then instead of being able to sit there and just browse, I would just say ignore limit for 15 minutes. And so I have this like maximum wall that I can hit as far as, you know, doing something kind of
well, like this. And then and it's less actually about the time as it's about the act of decision, right? Because then after 15 minutes passed, and then you get to decide, am I going to continue? Mm-hmm. But now there's a thing that's like, you've hit the limit that you said you wanted, right? So this is your responsibility.
Are you still having a good time? Yeah. But I think another note here is that even if you're having a good time, there's, I think, one of the most important things I read a long time ago, a couple of years ago, before I really started actively trying to take care of all this stuff for myself, was I think some big snowboarder or something, and they were remarking about how weird it is that people only seek help for the things they know are problems in the middle of dealing with the problem.
Like I'm doing right now.
Yeah. As opposed to I think you're still on the forefront of it.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
I
think so. It's like it started to be a problem.
But
I didn't do anything like proactive. Well, I guess, but it's an interesting problem, right? It's like you don't know if a thing is going to be a problem, so.
But sometimes you do, you know, like, so for example, like, you know, dealing in my case, I have some PTSD from all the cancer stuff. And literally for years, I've known this. And they told me afterwards, they were like, you're going to have PTSD. Do you want to see someone? And I was like, nah, I'm good.
I'm a man.
I feel nothing. And then, you know, after a few incidents where it like sprang on me super hard. One time I was at the gym, hopped on a pull-up bar, saw my arm. That was it. Saw my underarm, which of course, you know, there's a bunch of tendons and shit in there. And I was like, oh man. I see
break out in a cold sweat.
Fucking note. I just left the gym, didn't like do anything for the rest of the day. I just kind of fucked up. And this happened enough times that, finally I was like, you know, maybe I should do something about it. But I decided to do something about it in a window of time where I think it'd been like 6 months since I'd had any sort of episode. And I think it's an important note here, which is if you know there's a thing as an issue, oftentimes the best time to take care of it is actually when you're in a position of strength already.
Yeah. Well, especially for things like depression and stuff, right? Because the most insidious thing about depression, it's like horrible in every dimension, but the most insidious thing is how it actively prevents you from addressing it. Because its whole thing is, oh, that thing that you want to do? Nope. Nah. Yeah. So now you're, everything becomes insurmountable. Right. I was already feeling that, because the reason that I hadn't already like made an appointment to see a psychiatrist and all that stuff was because every day I got to call someone. Right.
Yeah. You got to make a single phone call.
Part of that journey down a hole, you know? It's,
I've heard people describe, describe it as a depression nest when like your house or your room or whatever just becomes a complete shit show, like just clothes everywhere that aren't getting picked up, you know, just trash on the ground because you didn't want to walk to the trash can to throw it away or whatever, you know. And so it's also a big like milestone for people coming out of that phase.
Yeah, it's like you're cleaning up your room.
Yeah, like just going on this huge cleaning spree, which honestly I think is probably where the concept of spring cleaning comes from, because I think people do inherently like become, you know, more lethargic and demotivated in the winter months and stuff, and then spring comes on, you're like, I'm sick of this, and you just kind of go nuts.
First ray of sunshine and you go on a cleaning binge.
You finally feel something again,
and the sun reveals just how dirty your house has become.
Take care of your stuff. I mean, this is – it's silly because we know this in all other things. It's like you buy car insurance in case you get into an accident, right? So like you pre-invest in that because you know that at some point you're probably going to deal with a problem in that domain, right? And we do this in all kinds of areas of life. But yeah, mental health is one of those things that people are just like – it's so invisible and it's so personal that it's very hard to like really identify. Because like when you get into a car crash, it's like, yeah, that obviously happened. That's clearly what just happened. Mm-hmm. You know, you can define it, boundaries on it. Yeah. So that's it's good to talk about this stuff and get it out into the open so that people can more clearly identify when they've had a mental car crash.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So otherwise, in other life news, the election was yesterday, yesterday from when this podcast airs, but we're recording it several days before. Hope that went well. Mm-hmm. And this is going to age badly. I feel like. I'm sure everything went fine and all is well, and there's not any horrible pile on effects. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
So, and I'm also pretty confident that like what, you know, whatever the outcome was, people were very mature about it and handled it quite well. No one was harmed and everybody just said, cool, let's move on now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably how that went.
Yeah.
So like we said, take care of your mental health. look into resources. If you're an employer and you're listening to this podcast on Wednesday morning, just, you know, maybe consider giving your employees a day off, depending on what the state of the world is. You know, just
give them a day off to celebrate just how smoothly everything went and how nothing went wrong.
Totally.
Because, you know, we really need that after this year. Mm-hmm. Everybody just needs that moment to just really – appreciate how smoothly it went.
we needed a
win this year.
Fucking smooth.
everything went so good
the whole year.
Yep.
All right, before we fall into that black hole, we should move on to some other topic. But yeah, I do hope you voted though. So
yep.
Please have done that yesterday.
I do want to get into some more questions, but before we do that, I do want to talk a little bit about just what's going on in the studio.
What's happening?
So we're working on Crash Nights 2. It's going great. Making big leaps and bounds of progress. But there's an interesting thing that I just want to talk a little bit about, because this is our first time making a sequel. Mm-hmm. And it's also our first time really aggressively planning a game in advance. You know, we've got lots of thought work done around what the systems are going to look like, how big the game's going to be, how everything's going to sort of knit together. And normally the way that we make a game is, if you saw the GDC talk that I gave about our design philosophy of designing by chaos, if we're making a new game, our approach is typically to just can basically have a very vague endpoint. So in the case of original Crash Ends, we were like, we want a big open world game that's all about crafting and where you can have pets. And also there's quests. Mm-hmm. So that's like, that was the target.
Sick and we kind of just, I'll publish millions of dollars.
To be fair, it was hard to pitch the whole time that we were working on that game.
And so we just kind of, every day as we worked on it, we would just kind of look at where the game is and be like, how close are we to that as a like an overall concept?
It was more just like, what do we think we should do next?
What would be kind of fun to add, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we just did that for a couple of years. Actually, one of our friends over at Touch Arcade said he described it as feature creep, the game. We just kept adding stuff until eventually we just kind of ran out of time and money, and then we published it.
That led to Penny Arcade. When we were in the PAX 10.
PAX 10,
When they had read up a little description of each game at PAX 10 as they were talking about Crashlands, and they had some line that was like, it's probably easier to describe what Crashlands isn't.
Because they just kept taking stuff and putting it in.
Yep.
Is a really, honestly, it's a very fun and engaging way to make a game, you know, mm-hmm. because you're kind of always surprising yourself. You don't know what's coming next, and every week there's something new in the game that you had no idea was going to be there.
Yep.
Right? So it feels like you're making these big leaps of progress all the time. Where we're at with Crash Ends 2 is we're still making those big leaps of progress, but we're doing stuff that we already knew we were going to do. And so it's really interesting how different that feels, because it feels like it's moving slower. Mm-hmm. It feels like development is moving slower because of the lack of surprises.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like because we actually have a measuring stick. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Yeah. We know where we actually know what the end destination is, and we can look at where we are relative to that.
Right? Yes. You need it to be full. Yeah. 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 But I will say, I'm an insider, right? Since I'm not actually working on the game, but I still get to see it progress. Most of our stand downs after the workday, Seth will pull up Crashlands 2 and show kind of like what he was working on today, and I can show what the game looks like, right? Sam will pull up some art, show what the art looks like. And from an internal outsider perspective, this thing is fucking flying in terms of how fast stuff is changing and being added, and we're figuring stuff out. And the game already looks, which everyone's going to hate hearing because we're not going to let you see it, but it already looks really good. And it already feels actually like it's replicated a large extent of the feel and vibe of the original Crashlands. All the functionality isn't there, right? So there's like quote unquote combat, but mm-hmm. no weapons. So it's like that kind of stuff, right? So it doesn't have the fullness to it, but it already does feel like it has the feature set, or that feature set is progressing very, very rapidly. So I think it is interesting because my perspective on this, not being a person working on it actively, is that things are moving at least as fast as they were for any of our other titles. And I feel more positive about this one just because everything looks so much better and it's like, it's going to be such a better game. So I just feel even better about all of this. And I feel like there's a plan, so I know it's like everything about the plan part and seeing the progress makes me feel great as a person mm-hmm. not actively working on it. So it is really interesting that impact of being the person doing the work, of basically tackling a checklist of pre-designed things versus getting to design as you go, because the design part is part of the fun of working on a project and having like already done that. It's almost like you've already had the fun earlier, sort of in some sense.
Well, it's like we talked about a while back about the phases of game development. You know, one of the phases is the grind, right? Yep. Which is like, you now know what you need to do and you just put in the work. And interestingly, you know, because we did so much design work up front and so much prototyping up front.
And it's a sequel.
Yep. So a lot of the questions were answered in the previous game. So there's going to be a lot more of the grind, you know, a lot more of just doing the work and getting the thing built to spec, right? And there's tons of small details and iterations and wiggling around of things that we thought were going to work in a certain way, but then we need to tweak them a little bit. But the tweaks are not big.
No.
You know, it's like – it's even stuff like when we had the game just as cubes hitting other cubes, we made the attacks and the actions performed super fast because it turns out when your cube is unanimated and the only thing that you see is a progress bar filling up for it to like pick a cube berry off of a cube bush, if all that happens is there's a progress bar, then it's boring and you want that progress bar to be super fast. Mm-hmm. But if once you actually have a character in there who has hands and has some personality and is actually like slapping this shrub.
There's or an
like
animation sequence.
Yeah, plucking the berries off or whatever it is, then suddenly it taking a half second or three quarters of a second feels good and it feels right. Where it was just a progress bar, you wanted it to be over with in, you know, 0.2 seconds and then move on. So there's a lot of those kinds of like game feel things that are just impossible to simulate in your mind until you're interacting with the game. And those are that's where kind of like the discovery and fun is coming out of, mm-hmm. of building the thing.
It's kind of a different spot, I think, is an important idea there, right? Cause it's even, and I think appreciating when you see the difference, So you'll know that you've basically hit a checkbox, right? But still being able to appreciate the difference in feel of the game as a consequence, I think is where you still get to get that joy. Because for me, from the outside, like watching things progress, where it went from a box to a character that bounces, a character that had
still image, basically
a still image when it's standing there. It actually had like a animated like breathing sort of thing, but for a while there was a stand and walking animation that was just like a draft, not even stick figure, it was sort of like a outline-y kind of a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Of the character, and so it would flip and then actually currently the last version I saw was we had animated attacks, but it was all with stick figures, right? And so the character is like looks glorious and like this painted character thing that's just standing there breathing, right? And then starts walking, and now it currently is just bouncing, right? Which then like immediately pulls you out of the context.
With stiff legs.
Yeah, it doesn't feel real at all. And then you go to attack something. A thing, and it turns into a stick figure with a fucking sweet animation. But like everything is just so jarring and random but even those little pieces, like that, how dramatically the fact that when you go hit an object, you now turn into a moving character with a cool animation, right? The dramatic impact on how that thing feels is really important. And I think it's you have to kind of move where you're deriving the surprise and value from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's kind of what Seth and I were talking about, which is actually, and especially a lot of it right now, is we're still very early in all the system stuff. And so even things like, you know, in working on combat, we have these creatures, the Bugabuns, that are sort of our current prototype creature, kind of like the Wampet from original Crash Science, your basic enemy that we're using to build everything off of. And one of the things enemies have to do is get to you, right?
Yep.
And this is not a trivial problem, getting an enemy to get to you, to be able
pathfinding.
To fight. They have to do pathfinding. And so it's one of those things that we're working on the combat currently, but working on the combat is not actually just working on the combat. It requires, again, it's the whole building a toaster.
What are you fighting?
Yeah, it's the building a toaster from scratch problem, which is like to do that properly, you have to just reinvent the fucking universe. And so that's where we're at currently, which I feel like is also way more of a grind actually than a little bit further in where we start getting into like essentially the cool part. Cause like, again, making a creature go from A to B is like, damn it. Like just go, you know, I want you to be done with this. It
seems like a given.
Yeah. It should be that so should hard.
Just be, the other thing is it is a solved problem. You know, pathfinding in games is you can look up, there'd be 50 million articles about how to do it, and they all basically say the same thing, which is like use A star, break it down in these two different ways, right?
Mm-hmm. And then here's how to deal with the specifics of all these different circumstances you might find yourself in.
Yeah. So like, and again, it's the grind. You know what needs to happen.
You got to do it.
And the outcome, and this kind of comes back to this thing being a sequel compared to a new game, which is which we've done all these things in original Crashlands. Creatures did fight you, and they did travel from point A to B. Mm-hmm. They did all these things, and so
Crashlands 2 is currently just a worse but better looking Crashlands right now.
Well, yes, exactly. I think it's more interesting, right? It's like all of these ways in which things creatures fight you are more interesting actually already than they were previously. The way the character is able to move around and harvest and attacks is far more interesting than it was before.
Yep,
it's all more interesting, but it's still
just not
done.
It's missing so many systems. Yeah.
So I'm excited to get further along in dev, but it's been a bit of a weird. It's a weird time, I think, definitely for Seth and I, because it feels slow.
It is fast, but it feels slow, yeah. And it's a lot less surprising than the development style we are accustomed to. Mm-hmm. So, but it's coming along very well, and I'm still very pumped about it.
Yeah, I can't wait until we get to start showing this off to people. Like, I don't know when that's going to be, but I think it looks so good that I think people are going to.
People are going to flip. People are going to flip their lids.
So I think we just make sure we keep on just talking about how great it is so that – and then continue not letting anybody see it,
yep.
You know, just as
– dare I say it's probably going to surpass Cyberpunk's in terms of hype. You know, I'm pretty confident in that.
I mean, we have been doing a lot of motion capture for our slug monsters. And
we don't have Keanu, but we do have his cousin's roommate –
Jerry's
brother's nephew, sister. So
who just drew a picture that we're using as
We're not using it, but we did look at it.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's a strong connection
there. In there.
Anyway, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from D Snowpeck, who says, I've been playing your pre-Crashlands games for the first time, and I'm impressed with the breadth of genre. Roid Rage, arcade game, Tau Fight 2, Zelda-like, Quadrupus Rampage, Roguelike, Flop Rocket, Impossible Rage-Inducing Pain Fest. That's a genre. Accurate,
yep.
Can you talk a little bit about how long each game took to develop and why you chose to explore each genre? Thanks.
Hmm.
Ooh.
What's so probably a genre, not, you know?
You know what I mean? That's the real question.
And what makes a genre different, and why would it even be the case that a studio would stick into one genre and not have breadth? You know what I mean? What's that about?
You would think that the people making – if it's a small team, you would think that the people making the games have sort of a kind of game that maybe they're more passionate about than other kinds of game, and that they would come together to like try to make the best version of that thing. I think one of the things we've talked about in the past is that we oftentimes will try to seek out to make games that at least one of us doesn't like in terms of genre. Because if you aren't a huge fan of a genre, then you may have some legitimate critiques of sort of the shortcomings of that style of gameplay, and you'll want to then address those. What you find is if somebody is super excited about a particular kind of game, then what you may end up with is they just sort of try to recreate their favorite game, you know, without solving any of the problems or doing anything particularly new or interesting. So,
yeah, I think so. Go ahead.
You go ahead.
Fine. I think yeah, this is like this very slight lag is just always a problem. So I can't actually really address why we went into different genres, except for the fact that I don't think we were thinking about genre specifically. I think we were thinking, what are some ideas about kinds of games that we can make? And especially coming from a game jam background where you're making all kinds of games, because the prompt is the thing that focuses you, right? And you don't necessarily go right to genre first. You're focusing on just like, what kind of things could we do that matches this prompt? Mm-hmm. And then that kind of will just happen to fall more or less into one bucket in terms of like genre, right? And I think since our background is in game jams, because if your background is in, say, like AAA, where you spend like, you know, AAA studios tend to make one kind of thing, really, right? Mm-hmm. And so if that's your background where you spend enormous amounts of time making kind of one kind of thing, then I can see how that is the thing that you think about. Like that's the kind of game that you do. Well, if you're making 1,000 little games like over a weekend each, exploring different genres and whatever, I think genre starts to mean a lot less.
Yeah. You know? I mean, I think importantly, when it comes to why a studio might stick with a genre in particular, it's
expertise often, and investment.
It's investment. So when it comes to tooling, for example, so if you, we talk a lot about how, you know, we have a lot of scripts and stuff that we reuse from project to project. You can imagine if we had only been making, say, I don't know, a Crashlands style, you know, a crafting games or these sort of big procedural world based games, like had the same viewpoint. So actually a really good example of this is Supergiant. So Supergiant makes incredible games, and each one is actually, I would argue, in the same genre as far as like how the players interact with the game world. And yes, like one of them is basically Magical Basketball. The newest one is a roguelike. But as far as what the camera is doing, the isometric perspective, like a lot of this stuff that is just sort of the stuff, again, that we talk about with as we're working on Crashlands 2, the things that you just have to have solved to be able to make the damn game. If you're a studio who works inside of one particular genre over a long period of time, then you actually build a broad tool set that then allows you to stop having to bother so much with those base things and just be able to focus on the entertaining part, which is really, really powerful because even like any given engine just doesn't do any of that stuff out of the box for you, you know. So that's the benefit of like sticking to a particular genre. But when you're working in 2D, when you're working over the course of like 2 days, like Adam said with these jams, and that's sort of where you come from, then there's no momentum behind any particular genre.
Well, and you're also not even, yeah, you're not even using expertise because you don't, there's no specific relevant expertise. There's no specific relevant tools you've already made. Like you're just doing basically something random.
It's basically a generalist, more of a generalist design training, frankly, and philosophy overall. And so what you, for us, the reason we did any one of those games is, I mean, we even have, if you're checking out the older games, you should check out our itch page because there's a bunch of Game Jam games on there. And you will also be pleasantly surprised by the total range of wackiness available through all of those, including like the elevator simulator.
Yeah, yeah. I would say good luck identifying a genre for many of those of those titles.
It's the reason we decided to do those is just because at the time it was just like Adam said, the prompt is good. Prompts give you some weird thing to go work on, and making a small game is the best way to go explore a genre. And I think having a breadth of genres, part of the reason I like that we've done this in the past, is because you're able to pull these things into maybe whatever the core studio genre is. You know,
yeah. Well, the reason that Crashlands was described as like what isn't Crashlands, right? Is because of that background making all kinds of random stuff. And this is true for even Level. Like Levelhead's a platformer, right? Like that's the core gameplay. But in terms of your experience playing Levelhead, it's a lot more than just that, right? But if we even go back to the decision about making Levelhead, which I think we probably talked about at some point in the podcast, but the idea there wasn't, we didn't set out to make a platformer, right? We didn't set out to do that specifically. What we wanted to do was, we were working on Rumpus at the time. We knew we wanted to transition to this new tech stack. We knew it's that someday we were going to make Crashlands 2. Like we knew that was going to happen. But at that time, we didn't actually know what our next game was going to be. It was going to be just like another big project, right? And we wanted to make something that really leveraged our web tech for the first time, like in a very intentional way, in order to build a big user base for the next game. That was the goal. That was the business goal we had when we set out to make Levelhead. And at the time, our decision to make it wasn't like, okay, well, let's make a platformer because people like platformers and then blah, blah, blah. It was, we said, what kind of thing can we do that leverages our web tech that would get people to come into our system? Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, UGC, user generated content, stuff that users can make and share with each other. Okay, so what are some kinds of ways that we can build a game around UGC, right? And for whatever reason, there were a handful of things we were looking at, but the one that like that really stood out to us at the time was Mario Maker. Not a genre, again, it was just the game Mario Maker. Mm-hmm. And how that thing had a niche, and how that niche at the time, unfortunately, that niche got filled out before we launched, but at the time, that niche was not filled out properly, right? And so we were like, okay, so here's a kind of game that satisfies the business goal we have that we believe has a market, which happens to be a platformer, right? And so then we set off to make it. And as Seth can attest, we didn't know jack shit about making platformers. And so, you'll hear warnings like everywhere. Like people always tell any new game dev, like, don't make a platformer. It's a lot harder than you expect. And that was true. That was definitely true. But now we get to borrow that experience, though. Like, we get to take everything that Seth learned, that Seth learned from a making it work perspective, and Seth and Sam learned from a design perspective. And we get to take that and bring it into Crashlands too. Whatever the fuck that's going to mean, who knows, right? But it's going to be actually useful background experience for them.
Well, one of the things that we get to leverage is the concept of the switch system from Levelhead. Yeah. Because in Crashlands 2, we're building the world, which means we're making a world editor for ourselves to build out the scenes and the places in the world that the player's going to go to. And now that we've experimented with this idea of sort of user-created logic gates and switches and all these other things, we're able to then carry that concept forward as we're building Crashlands 2 and make much more sophisticated story elements, you know, around these sort of conditional events and stuff like that. So, even disregarding the platformer side of things, just the fact that we made a level editor that was for players to use informed a lot.
Well, so, by having a very, very high quality level editor, it made Sam's experience building all of the levels for the campaign of Levelhead so much better that the first thing, like literally the first thing we invested in for Crashlands 2, like as the project that we're working on, the first thing we invested in was having editors and settings menus and all the QA tools and like all that kind of stuff that we discovered through the development of Levelhead was so essential to being able to have a good development experience. It's not just that we need a world editor for Crashlands 2 we have one already. It's already there, right?
It's not great, but it's pretty good.
It's actually pretty good because you can zoom in and out. You can pan around really fast. And it all feels very fluid because that was the other thing too, is that part of the experience should actually feel good, right? It should have the same kind of call. And so that's kind of, I think, one of the fun takeaways from building a level editor game is that the developer experience should feel just as good as the target user experience. Because as Sam in particular can attest with Crashlands, the original, with the campaign creation system, with the Crashlands creator, right? That thing, janky as fuck. You had to be trained to use it, right? The interface, hideous. It's easy to do things wrong. Hard to fix mistakes, right? Like the whole, it's this long list of this is a clearly made for developers thing in the most sort of insulting way, right? Which is you just fucking deal with it. And I think moving from that path to the one we have now, where it's like the developer experience should also be really good. I think it's probably one of the biggest takeaways we had from making a game that has nothing to do with Crashlands.
If it's fun and easy to use a developer tool, you're going to use it more, and you're going to use it better. Right?
So you're going to
make a better game. You're going to have better content at the end of the day. So don't skimp on user experience, even if only you are the user of the thing.
Yep.
Yeah. Our next question comes from IC Bush, who says, I'm finding myself surrounded by loved ones that are sick, mostly cancer. Seth, how did you maintain the focus to program effectively while Sam was so sick? I think there may be a few of us in this boat right now. I'm sorry to hear that. So this was something that Adam and I both were wrestling with, because Adam joined the studio while Sam was sick. And there were actually quite a few times where, especially when things were really bad, when you were going through the 4 weeks in the hospital for the transplant, and we would just be getting these reports. You know, our mom was there helping Sam out. He was basically just fucked up beyond belief. So Sam was unable to really do anything, send text messages or report on anything.
I believe I was coughing so hard I was vomiting was what I was doing.
Yeah. couldn't stand. I mean, because what they do is they destroy your bone marrow completely, which, spoiler alert, it's important to have.
That's one of the many things they do, but the collection of all the things is always poison you really badly so that, with the goal being to just almost kill you, but definitely kill the cancer. That's always the fine line you're walking when it comes to that stuff.
Yeah. And so Sam was going through this for weeks, and Adam and I were on the outside just getting these kind of sprinkling of periodic reports from our mother. It'd be a text message like, Sam currently vomiting so hard he can't breathe. That's like, that's a text message we got. And so, and then we'd be like, what, you know, we respond and be like, is that expected? what the fuck is that about?
What do we do with this?
You know, and then a while later, it's like, oh yeah, no, this is what was supposed to happen. Everything's fine. And it's like, just, I mean, it still doesn't seem fine, but it seems, but okay. So there was actually a point where Adam and I were trying to work on some Crashlands stuff, and we just fucking couldn't. Because, you know, it's, if you're working on a, especially if you're working on a bigger game that has a lot of intricacies and a lot of considerations where you have to like really think deeply and long about how to build systems and whatever, you need a certain amount of mental overhead to commit to that.
And if in the grind, then you need a certain amount of mental fortitude to make yourself do it.
Yep.
Yeah. And there was a point where all this stuff was going on, and Adam and I looked at each other and we're like, we can't fucking do this. Like, we just need to we need to do something. So we ended up just not this. So we just sat down and we just like, we actually worked on this on a small puzzle game that we made over the course of a few days.
It's called Entropy, wasn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And it's all it is like you kind of, it's kind of 2048-ish, but not really.
You play with other people for some reason. I can't remember.
We actually had a turn-based thing where there was like a versus mode. Cause we were just like, maybe we can do a web thing or something. Mm-hmm. So we put that game together, and then just kind of threw it away. But like, we just needed something that was lightweight and inconsequential to sort of just put our minds into, that didn't take a lot of thought, you know. It's fucking hard, you know. If somebody you care about is going through that, it's really all you can think about. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, you have to. You definitely have to give yourself permission to, because we all have this, you know, productivity obsession and all this kind of stuff, right? And you got to give yourself permission in these kinds of scenarios to say, like, I gotta take care of, because you're taking care of yourself, right? A person who's sick, like, you can't take care of them, right? Like, in like, really, you can be there for them, and like, in some ways, if you are a caretaker, then you are actually taking care of them. But if you're a little bit on the periphery, then mostly what you're doing is like observing it happen, right?
Yeah, especially with cancer stuff, is basically the worst for this.
Yeah, because cancer stuff, that's a doctor's job. Your job is not to take care of that person, right?
Yeah, yeah. It becomes a solo endeavor for the patient that has basically a support squad who's like, I brought casserole, and that's exactly the thing. Right. And is trying to cheer you on. But actually, and as a patient, the weirdest thing is the fact that your existence during this time feels like it's causing everybody else a tremendous amount of pain.
Which is true.
Which is very true. And is one of the hardest things to deal. Like, frankly, like, I was like, I mean, I could get stabbed all day. Like, whatever, that's fine. But like, seeing other people react to me being stabbed and get all fucked up was somehow even worse than just me being stabbed in the first place. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Sort of an insult to injury thing.
So, one thing you should be doing is trying not to make the person who's sick feel even worse because of how bad you feel about them being sick.
Yes.
It is partly your job in that scenario to have as much sort of outward, you know, sort of
equanimity,
strength as possible, even if it's not inward. So certainly don't make things worse is a good approach to take. But otherwise, it's acknowledging that for most people in most parts of the relationship with the person who's dealing with shit, the best you can do is be support, where you provide things like, where possible, like maybe that's giving food, maybe it's just giving space, maybe, you know, whatever it is, right? But providing something that the person actually wants is the first thing, right? It's not, because that part of that relationship is not about you. That's about the person who's sick. That is who it is about. So like, don't make it about you. It's about that person. But that doesn't mean you're not dealing with shit. So make that about you without bringing that other person into it, right? So it's about identifying what you need for self-care and just accepting the fact that like things are shitty, and that is, it's okay for you to feel like shit as a consequence. And you need to identify the things that alleviate that for you. If that's if you're working a normal 9-to-5 of some sort, right? And if that's like just doing the bare minimum now because you can and you won't get fired, right? And accepting the fact that like everybody else around you just has to accept that, right? And if they're pissed off about it, fuck them, right? And spend your evenings, like maybe previously you'd be spending your evenings like trying to become a better, whatever it is your job is or whatever, right? But now you're just like, I'm going to go to escapism and just play video games and read lots of books, or spend more time with my family, or get a dog, or you know, whatever the fuck, right? Like find the thing. Like, I just accept that you need self-care. and just do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I do think a big part of it actually comes down to a control issue, which is as the support person watching from the outside, you don't, especially in the case of someone got cancer, you just don't have, there's just nothing you could do. Or at least it seems like that, I would say, on the face. But I think what was so interesting going through it was watching everybody figure out a thing that they could do. So actually for Adam, so in Adam's case, I mean, Adam fucking left his PhD program and came to work at the studio. Like that.
Yep.
I mean, the inciting incident was the sickness stuff, right? Like that was the thing. And so,
yeah, basically I told my advisor team, there's a word for that, but it's been so long, I can't remember. But I was like, I need to graduate as fast as possible. How do I do that? And so we made a plan for, I think it was 6 months after that date. My life plan completely changed, right? From being like, I'm going to be a career scientist to, okay, I'm going to graduate as fast as possible. And then I'm going to just be done with that, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah.
And make video games, I guess.
And even before that, though, Adam and mom and dad all functioned as very intense researchers, actually. So as we were heading into treatment, like, I don't even know where the fuck it came from, but everybody had apparently read all the papers. They're all, because of course it's a family of medical people and scientists. So it was a very nice background to have as far as my crew. But I think importantly, like the thing you get to do, like what your thing is, can be anything from assisting with sort of aspects of the treatment process to just assisting with pieces of life. And so like my wife, for example, basically learned, like this is essentially the time where she learned to cook really, really well, because her whole thing was like, this guy needs to eat good food. Mm-hmm. And he can't taste most things, so like, right. So we gotta take this up. And then she got super into cooking through that process. And so I think part of it is finding a way that you can busy yourself that is essentially assisting the person without having to get in their way. Kind of like Adam was saying, seems like a really powerful part. And for Seth, it was programming on Crashlands is actually a big part of a lot of that stuff too.
It was the big thing. Because it was actually the case that there was during that time span, I essentially didn't watch Netflix. I didn't play video games. Mm-hmm. I didn't read books. I just programmed Crashlands because that was part of my thing that I can control, that I feel like is directly sort of helping Sam sort of emotionally get through the thing that he was dealing with, right? Which is like, I didn't want him to be worried about whether we were going to get this game done,
right?
You know, no matter what our timeline was, no matter what was going to happen with the cancer stuff, it was like, I wanted him to feel like this game that I believe in and that I want to like put out into the world is going to make it, you know? So, I mean, that was my thing, but it really just does come down to trying to think of anything you can do to offer support and bring some measure of control into what's happening, you know, into your day to day.
Yeah. And again, that often means, making sure you're not making it about you. Right. I think as Sam can attest, like having to deal with an endless stream of like friends and family, right.
Oh yeah.
Wanting to like do something and like, and show that they care and all that kind of stuff. On the one hand is like, it's like intellectually nice, but in the moment is not emotionally nice, right? Yeah.
Because or that whole like, if there's anything I can do, you just let me know. And it's like, don't put that back on them. Just do stuff. You know, if you just bring them some soup, you know, they're not going to be like, actually, could you bring me some soup? I really want some soup, you know, because they're dealing with their own shit and they don't want to feel like they're burdening you with making you do stuff. Just.
Yeah. And one of the, you know? And we were talking about before, but like the projection of sadness onto me was the most annoying thing. Cause I may be having a perfectly good day, you know? Mm-hmm. And like, especially because you're on a lot of drugs. So like, you know, I'm on some fucking from prednisone. I'm like raged out. I'm like kind of happy, a little high basically because of it, you know? And then someone comes up with their whole like sad eyes and they're like, how are you doing? And I'm like, just
how are,
I'm
not how here for this
today. Like, I'm having a good time.
Well, I saw that as a lot of like my particular role was just to basically not pretend like it's not happening in a way where I'm like, this is irrelevant to whatever, but just like just go on and participate as like as a sibling who was like, yeah, this is just a thing that you're dealing with, and I and I'm helping out where I can, but otherwise we're doing other stuff.
It's
we're
providing
talking about a, let's just have a talk, good let's have a good yeah, time. Have a
providing
good
time. A sense of normalcy is honestly big.
Yeah,
and then one of the other things that I believe my wife ended up taking on a bunch for me was essentially managing all this, all the incoming stuff from people.
Yeah.
So she was like, if everybody has any questions, like ask me instead. Or like all of our friends who were like, you know, friends or like acquaintances and stuff in town who suddenly wanted to like drop by and say hello. And then we just like Diana just took care of it. Because
and most talk to my agent.
Yeah, exactly. And honestly, like that was tremendous. Because again, like you're already dealing with all this other stuff and having to reject people constantly because you don't want to see anybody today is very annoying. It takes a lot of mental bandwidth away from the whole, you know, not dying process.
It is. Do you think it's probably the case too that like, especially as an introvert, you know, going through this where you just want to like go through your day on your own terms. Be generally left alone, mind your own business, and have a good time, right?
Oh, yeah.
And one of the one of the things that happens when you get sick like that is, like you said, suddenly everybody just appears.
Everyone wants to be in your business.
They feel like they need to express something, you know,
which is understandable. And it's like it's not bad, right? But you do have to understand that the consequences of it's just like in anything, right? Intent doesn't matter nearly as much as outcome. And so it doesn't matter that you're like, oh my God, what if I don't get to see this person again? Right. I need to make sure I see this. It's like, it's not about you. Right.
What about what they want?
Yeah. And again, it's that two sides. Like both things are true at the same time, right? That person's sickness is not about you in the sense that they need to deal with it however they need, and you should help them however you can, but don't make that part about you. The fact that it impacts you is real and is about you. That part is. You figure out how to deal with that part yourself, and you don't make that there. And that's if you could find that balance and like acknowledge, like explicitly identify the parts of those two little mountains, right? And do things for yourself, do things for that person. Don't let those concepts mix. Then you're going to do a great job.
Yep.
Yeah. Because again, as much as it may be affecting you that somebody who is very central to your life or who you care about a lot is going through something terrible, it is happening to them first.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Like whatever happens to you is because of a far worse thing already happening to them.
Yeah.
Right. So,
which doesn't make it any less real. Doesn't make it any less of a problem.
It really sucks for you, but you're definitely the second party in this scenario.
So you find those helpful control outlets. I honestly think so much of it is just about a sense of agency. So if you can find a useful thing that you could do, then
do that thing.
Just do that thing. And sometimes they're temporary. Sometimes it's like not all of them are long term. Like when I went my first treatment for my first transplant, Adam made the vibe wall.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It might still be up somewhere. Which basically was this thing that people could just go post good vibes on just in the hospital. And like tons of our friends did it. We put up on Twitter, a bunch of fans did it. I think Rami posted something.
Yeah, Rami Smail posted a thing.
Again, a bunch of people who
there were like 500 things by the time it kind of figured out.
And like, I didn't know that was happening. Adam was just like, hey, I made this vibe wall. And I was like, what? And then it was like,
people could send good vibes.
Yeah. And like,
well, the fact is, like, that didn't have to happen in the sense that we could have just like posted on Twitter, like, hey, send Sam some good vibes, reply to this tweet.
But you know? Need something to do. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But Adam needed a thing to make, a thing to put his time into to show, you know.
And only one – there was nobody who was a straight-up asshole in that, which was impressive. But there was only one person who kind of ruined it that made me have to add a delete button, which is somebody who was like, this is my moment to convert Sam to Christianity.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're on there.
And I can't tell you the depth of the rage that I felt when that comment appeared on thing.
Because again, that's making it about yourself. Yeah. You know, it's you saying, oh no, this is something that I'm going to do, you know, to make myself feel better about what this person is going through.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Don't send people articles about like crystals and stuff either. I lost, I'm pretty sure, like 3 or 4 friends who were like, well, just got along with great. And then they came out of crazy town for this.
They're like Sam, the thing is, you just got to exercise more and just be in the sun a little more and maybe just eat some kale.
You know, there's all this like metaphysics. Do you think like you've been harboring, you know, a lot of negative thoughts
and this metamorphosed into cancer. And I was like, fuck yourself.
How's that? I feel like that's a real kind of like, that's a real kind of failure to read the room.
Yeah. You know? Right. Like, I'm dying.
But also like know who you're talking to.
If the person's into that, if the person like is into Christianity, if they're into crystals, if they're into whatever, jump on, participate, whatever.
Jump on board.
But if that person's like, in Sam's case,
I believe in science.
I believe in science. Yeah, I've been treated by scientists. I've got this whole thing. I've got a team. We're doing all this kind of stuff. Don't fucking come in swinging your nonsense. Don't do that.
Yeah.
So
read the room. Read the room. If nothing else, just read the dang room. So, all right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the community Discord, a way for you to donate to support the podcast, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.